The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Can you buy friends? I mean, can parents buy friends of their children? Can neighbors or relatives do it? Have you ever known anyone who has been able to buy a friend? We try it in society all the time. We think gifts and favors. We think especially gifts of money or political position, status, prestige. Some favoritism that is handed back by politicians to heavy contributors to campaigns, for example. Well-known methods of trying to purchase favors and buy friends. But how quickly all of that can turn around and rend you when you least expect it. Right now, the United States of America is trying desperately to buy friends abroad. Well, what do I mean right now? We've been trying it for as long as I can remember, as long as I've been alive, and as long as anyone else has been alive. But does all of this attempted purchasing of friends, allies, staunch supporters in times of crisis really work in the long run? What it's costing the Americans in terms of taxation, the taxpayers' dollars that go into aid abroad, into arms expenditures, into the attempts even today to keep major institutions of the United States aloft financially by infusion of massive sums of Arab money, earned, of course, by the exorbitant quadrupling of Arab crude oil, and other such institutions, even like railroads and cattle ranches and industries of all types, and even in land development schemes and mines, mining properties, all of these being snapped up by Arabs and Japanese and other countries alike. It's not only this, though, it's the giveaway program that we're upon right now. Around the world, not only sales of arms and arms transfers, but even giving away of arms abroad. We hope somehow we are going to be able to gain influence. But does that really gain that kind of influence? Let's look at a few examples and find out. Even though, as I've said in recent programs, we would think that people in the CIA or the Pentagon or people in government are men of stature, of wisdom, of discretion, men of tremendous knowledge, men of an accumulated experience and caution that makes them reason and think and move and think and say and do on a plane that is somehow exalted and far better than those of us who are laymen, so that their reasoning would naturally escape us. Yet when I read that State Department officials say that the outpouring of American arms into the Middle East is supposed to bring stability to that area, I really wonder whether or not that assumption is true. It wasn't long ago in the Cypriot situation where a military government in Greece, which was critically dependent, of course, on American military aid, by the way, and political backing, of course, deposed the president of Cyprus, Archbishop Makarios, and the continuing crisis that had been underway for a long time was rubbed raw and exploded in war. So it was back on July 20th last year that Turkish troops, incidentally they were using American weapons, driving American trucks, they were supported by a Navy and Air Force equipped and armed by the United States, U.S. fighter bombers, U.S. planes, ships, tanks, guns, and even U.S. uniforms and helmets. For all the world, from a distance, they looked like American soldiers. But so did the people they were fighting against, the Greeks. It must have been hard to tell them apart. Maybe some of them wore dress uniforms and the others fatigues. Maybe it was the shoulder patch. Maybe they had to get close enough to see whether or not they were clean-shaven or wore a Turkish mustache. I don't know. But I know that the Turks and the Greeks both wore American uniforms, carried American weapons, fought each other from American-made tanks and trucks and with American arms, and were landed by American naval vessels, of course, in Turkish or Greek hands. There have been many nations that have fought wars supplied by common sources, and it's becoming more common all the time. India and Pakistan, for example, fought each other with American-made equipment. In the Middle East, Israel is armed with American, British, and French weapons, and Arab nations are armed with American, British, and French weapons, as well as communist weapons. And recently, of course, Mr. Sadat went over to France shopping around for additional French weapons and kind of crying in his beer because he said the Soviet Union had not yet compensated Egypt for the arms it lost in the latest round of war in the Middle East, the Yom Kippur War of 1973. I suppose when State Department officials and when the Pentagon says that we believe we're going to get our money's worth, not only in terms of helping our balance of payments deficits in this country by sales of arms abroad, which of course fuels our industries and brings us additional millions or billions of dollars. And remember, as I reported recently, the United States is the largest trafficker in arms around the world, way ahead of the Soviet Union. We could make two of them in the billions we're spending and the arms that we are pouring into nations, Central and South America, Africa, the periphery of Southeast Asia, and in the Middle East. I presume if the Soviet Union wanted some, we would sell them our F-14s. Although since their MiG-23s are supposed to be superior, I don't think they really need any. But if they wanted them, I'm sure we would. We sell them wheat and everything else they want, don't we? Well, here's an example about how quickly an ally we think we bought can turn. Recently, it was noised abroad that Turkey is making plans to close some or all of United States bases in its country. That, of course, following the cutting off of U.S. military aid. So you see, you can't discipline these countries like some loud voices in Congress would like to do without having the consequences. The consequences are no more SAC bases in Turkey. No more overflights by SR-71s or the latest generation of U-2s over the Soviet missile bases. Turkey has traditionally been used as the one jumping-off point from which American surveillance of Soviet nuclear depositions has been constantly maintained. And of course, Turkey is the closest foothold that the United States has had, right below the steppes of communist Russia, right below the area of Sevastopol and some of the oil ports of the Black Sea. And here is Turkey, supposedly a staunch ally of the United States, recipient of millions upon millions and hundreds of millions over a period of many, many years of American arms and military aid. Well, Foreign Minister Meles Encebel was quoted recently by Newsweek magazine in an interview as saying that closures would be on a graduated scale of military bases because American arms were used in the invasion of Cyprus last July. Now, had Turkey invaded first, American arms would have been used, and of course American arms were used in the defense of it as well as in the attack of it, but that seems to have escaped the gentleman. He actually said that U.S. aid was no special favor to Turkey anyway. So even though our government tells us it is, and we sigh and think of the pinch of the pocketbook and the tax dollars going out, the man who sits over there receiving it says, well, we really don't need it. For $90 million, a paltry sum by present-day standards, not to you and not to me, no, of course, but to him, yes. The United States and NATO were supposed to be getting one of the best security bargains in all the world because Turkey controlled the vital Dardanelles exit from the Black Sea and had permitted the installation of 20 American early warning listening and tracking stations. So we were pretty well ensconced in Turkey, air bases and all the rest of it. Well, the gentleman said in Newsweek magazine, and he was not bluffing, he said, this is no bluff, believe me. We are not interested in aid programs which have expiration deadlines and which say, if you do not do thus and so, at the end of a certain time, you will be cut off without military aid. He has a strange point of view, don't you think? Many educational institutions who know when they become accredited and can become VA approved and become eligible for governmental monies fully expect a certain measure of governmental surveillance and control over governmental monies and don't really noisily complain about it all that much. Almost everybody who prostitutes himself for more money from other sources expects to be able to shell out his end of the bargain when the time comes. Not this Turk from Turkey. He doesn't feel that any American favors are forthcoming. So it's a rather strange agreement in this case. It's rather strange. It's weird. It's as if the bargain is only one way. You're there at the leisure or the pleasure of the Turks, but unless they need you, don't worry about it. They'll call you when they need you. But in the meantime, send them the money. Send them the arms, send them the aid, send them the help, and shut up about what they do in their own internal affairs. You know, there was a story I heard years ago about an old snowy white-haired gentleman with a kind of a lewd and lascivious look on his face, who approached a young lady sitting at the bar, sat down beside her, and said, "Hello there, baby cakes. I'm not really this tall. I'm sitting on my wallet." And then he said, "Hey, for $1,000, would you consent to go with me to Honolulu for a long weekend?" And she said gushingly, "Oh, would I?" He said with an evil gleam in his eye, "Would you do it for $500? She said, "Well, sure." He said, "How about $100? You're paying the hotel and all the meals and everything else? I still get $100? You're paying all my expenses?" "Yeah." "Okay, I'll go for $100. He said, "How about $2? She says, "What do you think I am, buddy?" He says, "Calm down, lady. We've already settled exactly what you are. Right now we're haggling about the price." Back in the Bible, there are analogies given about God's relationship with God's people, and I believe that the American people are one of the many nations who were originally in their forebears and ancestors recipient of those covenant promises with God. And even if you don't believe that, and that's not essential that you do, it is nevertheless true that there is cause and effect, that there is a God, that there are laws of that God, that there is a great purpose and a program being worked out here below, that it's being worked out on a scheduled time series or sequence of events, of one event overlapping another one, and coming on the heels of a former one, and that there is a program being worked out on this earth. There are lessons that are supposed to be learned. Originally, when God Almighty was dealing with the nation of Israel, He gave you a few human examples, just like the story of the old lecherous guy that's going to take the girl to Honolulu. They're sometimes tragicomic. The old covenant is called a marriage agreement in the Bible. And when the nation who said all that you have said in the Ten Commandments, "We will do," entered into an agreement and a covenant with God that said, "We will be faithful to you. You're our protector. You're our provider." The Bible says that God is the banner, the sword, the shield. He is the military establishment. He is the security. He is the source of all the great blessings of good land, of good soil, of longevity of life, of healthy babies, of an absence of disease, an absence of military taxation or conscription and the heavy tax burden of today, an absence of wars, protection from enemies. That he, like a protector, provider, lover, husband, father, all of those proprietary abilities and capacities of God, would see to it that this nation, who in this sense, in the analogy, for the sake of the analogy, plays the part of the bride, and he the part of the bridegroom or the suitor, she would be faithful and he would be faithful. She abides by the promise and is obedient to him. She gets every blessing under the sun on the face of the earth. And so long as she does, the blessings just follow rapidly, one on the heels of another, so great that she can't contain them all. Back in the 16th chapter of the book of Ezekiel is a story about a little baby, and it's God's people by analogy, as if it is lying there, not even swaddled, and with sores and dirt all over it. But God picks it up and loves this child until it grows into a young woman. But later on, even though it says in verse 13, "You did prosper into a kingdom, and your renown went forth among the heathen for your beauty," and there was an agreement entered into between that young nation, that fledgling nation. Here the analogy is easy to see, that there is a kind of a representation of Israel coming out of Egypt anciently, way back in ancient history. Of God becoming the protector and provider, and Israel saying, "Yes, we will keep your laws." But then it begins to get into the analogy of harlotry. And it says in verse 33, speaking of, as it says, fornication in verse 29 or adultery, verse 32, they, those who do that, give gifts to all whores, the lovers who pay for their favors. But you, it says in verse 33 of the 16th chapter of Ezekiel, give your gifts to all your lovers. The Bible shows then that unlike the average prostitute who would expect payment in return for her favors, God's people give their favors and give a gift. Now think about what I was talking about earlier about Turkey, about American aid, favors, pouring out our arms, our money, our wheat, our foodstuffs to countries which rarely, if ever, support the United States in the UN or support U.S. policies, and willing to give them more and more and more, and see if this analogy doesn't seem to fit. It says, verse 34, the contrary is in thee from other women in your whoredoms, whereas none follows you to commit whoredoms, and in that you give a reward, and no reward is given to you, therefore you're contrary. You are different. God says there's a different kind of whoredom committed by His people. He draws the analogy of a nation that calls itself after the name of God, that prints on its bills, "In God We Trust," that claims to be a nation founded on Christian principles, that claims to be a country founded under the banner of belief in God, of faith in God, of trust in God. Not only is it whoredom, he says, then, to traffic with foreign countries who are potential enemies, but it's a unique and an unusual relationship, because unlike other harlots who take gifts, this particular harlot gives them away. And that doesn't seem to make sense. And yet that's exactly the analogy the Bible uses. You ought to read through the entirety of the 16th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, because some of the language is a little strong, even for the radio program, believe it or not. But it's in the Bible, there it is. It talks about lovers, it talks about the corrupt ways of these women, and they're both, by analogy here, Samaria and Judah, the northern capital of Israel, and the southern capital of Judah of that time. And it goes on and on through that analogy, just repetitiously over and over again, and shows what God thinks about this trading and trafficking with potential enemies abroad. Yet, as never before, in this precise moment, it seems we are doing exactly that. Governments argue that supplying arms, goods, food, aid abroad is beneficial, that even there is an altruistic side to trafficking in arms. They say that we gain influence, that we promote peaceful resolution to conflicts, that we promote cooperation and partnership. Do we really? Is that what we are promoting right now in the Middle East? Is that what is going on as Mr. Kissinger, in his step-by-step shuttle diplomacy, tries to bring about a solution in the Middle East? Here we are with major concerns and firms representing really directly Arab governments, as well as the government of Iran, which, though not Arab, is nevertheless Islam and religion, and is one of the OPEC oil-producing countries of the Middle East. And we are finding great, proud, old American institutions being virtually gobbled up by monies from abroad, and at the same time, our military establishments are being kicked out of some of the most important perimeters of NATO, nearest to the Soviet Union. And we were hoping all these years that we had bought all of those favors. It looks like we're getting it going and coming, doesn't it? Looks like we're hanged if we do and hanged if we don't. Now, right now, Mr. Kissinger is on a visit to the Middle East, and he is finding that the Israelis are going to insist on a non-belligerency pact on the part of Egypt before they negotiate about withdrawing from some of those strategic passes in the Sinai. Meantime, Sadat, though guaranteeing that Egypt will not attack Israel, also says that the Israeli vessels cannot use the Suez Canal until some non-belligerency pact has finally been signed. And also, meanwhile, Faisal wants now a meeting between Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Yasser Arafat, because he's quite concerned that Egypt may want to go it alone and may give in to Henry Kissinger. Why? Well, because Egypt is playing its own both ends against the middle in being the recipient of American nuclear reactors, American aid, food shipments, and the promise of warming relationships between the United States and Egypt, which began in the Nixon administration. Meantime, Syria and the PLO are afraid that Egypt will conclude some pact about Sinai, but might leave out consideration of Syria, Golan, and the West Bank. And meantime, the United States, sitting astride the fence, trying to keep an ear to the ground on both sides, is trying to conciliate between, quote, friends, end quote, on all sides of this bitter and protracted struggle. We are supplying arms to almost all the Arab countries, from Oman to Bahrain to Abu Dhabi to Kuwait to Lebanon to Iran to Saudi Arabia, and at the same time a staunch and loyal supporter of Israel. Can you imagine how difficult that makes the job of a man named Henry Kissinger? Since the United States is trying to buy favors on all sides. Well, I'd like now to take you to Jerusalem. My son Mark reported just before coming on the broadcast by telephone. This came over the wire just moments before I came on the air.
Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem. Since Henry Kissinger's visit to the Middle East last week, Jerusalem has made it plain that Israel will insist on a direct pledge of non-belligerency from Egypt before withdrawing from the Dilka and Gitti passes and the Abu Ghraib oil deal. Israeli leaders have been less optimistic about the settled diplomacy mission than Dr. Kissinger. Officials say he did not bring much information regarding Israel's standing with Egypt that they did not already have. It has been stated that both Israel and Egypt will take very tough positions in advance of Dr. Kissinger's Middle East visit next month in order to gain any possible negotiating advantage. Egyptian President Sadat, in his first interview since Dr. Kissinger's visit, has said that he rejects Prime Minister Rabin's demand for a written pledge of non-belligerency within the framework of another interim agreement. But Sadat has promised that Egypt will not attack Israel as long as the search for peace continues. Sadat has said that the Suez Canal is prepared for navigation and will be opened in the near future. He also stated that Israeli flagships will not be allowed to cross the waterway until Egypt and Israel sign a non-belligerency pact in Geneva and Israel has withdrawn from all occupied Arab territory. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia is reported to be trying to arrange a meeting of the heads of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and with Yasser Arafat of the PLO to unify Arab views before Henry Kissinger visits the Middle East again next month. King Faisal is concerned over mounting tension between Syria and the PLO on one hand and Egypt on the other. Syria and the PLO are afraid that Egypt will conclude an agreement with Israel that will involve a withdrawal in the Sinai, but won't include a pullback of Israeli forces from the Golan Heights or the recognition of the rights of the Palestinian people on the West Bank. A preliminary meeting of President Sadat, King Hussein of Jordan, and President Assad of Syria is expected to take place in Amman before the end of this week. President Assad has made it plain that he regards efforts toward a separate second-stage agreement between Israel and Egypt as an attempt to split and weaken the Arab military unity of the Yom Kippur War. In talks with Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko yesterday, Henry Kissinger agreed that the Geneva conference should resume at an early date, but feels the conference will go much better if a preliminary settlement can be worked out between Israel and Egypt in advance. Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem.
And so the Middle Eastern merry-go-round continues, and there is no end in sight. Self-interest, selfish personal interest, as well as national interest, is placed well ahead of the interests of all of humanity. Another case in point is that of Pakistan recently, where Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who is the prime minister, said Pakistan would develop nuclear capability if it could not get enough arms for a conventional deterrent. There has been an embargo on American arms to Pakistan. Rather strange when you stop to think of all the other areas where we are willing to send our arms and our support. But as a result of our continual support of India, which is, in a sense, rather strange when you look at the fact that India has never supported the United States in the United Nations and almost always goes contrary to U.S. interests in the United Nations. Be that as it may, we still continue to support India. So it would look a little embarrassing to supply a very large conventional weapons deterrent to Pakistan. India might scream. There again, we're astride the fence, and we're hanged if we do and hanged if we don't. Now, the Prime Minister of Pakistan threatens, though these aren't really intended to be threats, that Pakistan is now prepared to go nuclear, and they will concentrate all their energies on acquiring nuclear capability unless the United States is willing to supply them with a sufficient conventional deterrent. You know, in years gone by, when I was doing programs about what kind of a world will it be, I asked over 10 years ago, when Pakistan and India both have nuclear weapons. We're not going to have long to find out, are we? What kind of a world is going to be? I said, what kind of a world will it be when not just the two big powers, three, four, or five, as today, France, Britain, the Soviet Union, the United States, and of course Red China, have the atomic and the hydrogen bomb. But what about adding Japan, Indonesia, the Philippines, Israel, Egypt, Pakistan, India? What about adding some of the hostile Central and South American countries who are infamous for starting wars even over soccer games? What kind of a world will it be, armed to its nuclear teeth, where little nations all over the world possess nuclear capability? I've got to give you something out of Art Buchbog's column, which is coming along in the Plain Truth magazine, by the way, although we've gone tabloid twice a month, and the second issue is out, which I talked about a good bit yesterday, which you can have, including these articles on curing the English sickness, Bombay, vision of India's future, the politics of eternity, the personal from the editor, my father, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, the article on tidal wave of red ink straining the United States economy, and also how the Shah of Iran plans to spend oil billions, and also in my Speaks Out column, the commentary about American arms pouring into the Middle East and what that's going to lead toward. We carry Buchwald's column, by the way, and the current one, which will be coming out a little later on in the PT, I've got to share with you now. The National Security Council, he said, was in executive session when a CIA man rushed in. All of this, of course, purely fictitious, but rather instructive nevertheless. He had a cable. He said, the Cubans have just made a big oil strike in the Bay of Pigs. It ought to be the biggest oil find in the Western Hemisphere. The dirty rats, somebody said. Wait a minute, said a man from the Defense Department. That's no way to talk about the island bastion of freedom in the Caribbean. Are you crazy, the State Department man said. We're going to have to help them defend themselves, the Defense Department said. Against whom, a White House aide asked. Us, the Defense Department man said. Remember, Cuba is only 90 miles away from Miami. I say we go in and take the oil, said the CIA. What? Said the defense. That could kill one gigantic plane sail. Cuba will need some very sophisticated fighters now that they've got oil. Not to mention anti-tank weapons, tanks, and armored carriers, his assistant said. I wouldn't be surprised if they order $1 billion worth of arms. Wait a minute, are we going to sell Castro war material, said State? Do you want the French to do it, defense asked. Or the Russians, his assistant said. But we don't even recognize Cuba diplomatically. What's that got to do with selling them arms? Defense wanted to know. They got oil. They're entitled to buy anything they want to from us. Exactly, said Treasury. And besides, we've got to think of our balance of payments. He's right, said the White House. After all, Castro isn't a bad guy. He'll probably need destroyers, defense said. We've got some new ones now being built with fantastic radar, but we wanted to give them to the Navy, but the Navy can wait. I wouldn't be surprised if Castro wanted nuclear submarines. Well, we've got them. They're on station now in the North Atlantic. We can deliver them in about 30 days. I don't want to throw cold water on a big military sail, but are we sure the Cubans can handle all this sophisticated materiel? We'll train them, dummy, defense said. You mean our soldiers and sailors will train the Cubans in weapons they may use against us? Of course not. You think we're idiots? We'll contract the training to a private company made up of Green Berets, ex-Marines, and Naval Ordnance Men. In that way, we'll be removed from the sail in case there's any flack from Congress. Interesting, isn't it? Write for the Plain Truth. You'll get that column as well as these other articles I've talked about in these ironic situations of what is happening in the world today in the light of Bible prophecy. We'll get it in the mail to you as quickly as we receive your letter. There's never any bill to follow. We would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.